In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 321. I'm talking today to Thaddeus Russell, author of A Renegade History of the United States. Thad teaches American history and cultural studies at Occidental College. He's appeared on the History Channel, Fox News, and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He holds a PhD in history from Columbia University, and you can visit him at ThaddeusRussell.com. Thad, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
One of the things I like about you is that I can't quite figure you out completely. That's great. You know, you're not a cookie cutter anything. You're just a guy with a lot of really interesting insights, and you don't care if you borrow insights from this person or that person or that person. As if somebody has an insight, you're interested in it. And oddly enough, this is an extremely rare characteristic, so congratulations.
Well, that's really flattering. That's exactly how I like to be thought of, actually. And that's how I think of myself. You're right, I don't really fit into any particular category. I mean, I borrow from many different influences, which we can talk about, but I'm sort of always, I find pretty serious discontent with any political strain of thought. And so I like to be free-floating, yes. And a moving target, that's the most important thing.
Well, one thing that is interesting about your book, A Renegade History of the United States, is that the blurbs kind of illustrate the point that I just made. If you look at the different sorts of people who have blurbed it, I blurbed it, and Alan Brinkley blurbed it. Now, Alan Brinkley is about the most straight-laced, but also, you know, politically left-liberal guy you can imagine, and he was my dissertation director.
He was mine as well.
Oh, he was yours as well? I didn't realize that. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
well, also, now I know how you got him to blurb the book, because I was going to say, it doesn't really seem like his kind of book.
No. I mean, Alan is unusual in that he's, you're right, he's a fairly doctrinaire left liberal, but he is has tremendous integrity.
That is exactly how I felt.
Yeah.
Even though we didn't agree on politics, what difference does that make? He's my dissertation advisor, and it's his job to critique my chapters and make it into a good work and get me through the defense. And that's exactly what happened, and he was terrific through it.
He's one of the only people from that world who has treated me fairly throughout my career, actually.
Well, that's kind of how I felt.
My work, my dissertation under him, and my subsequent work especially, has been a full frontal assault on everything he believed. He treated me well and gotten me jobs and written letters of recommendation and written blurbs for my books, so I can't complain. I mean, it's quite unusual. I mean, I'm very much used to being stabbed in the back or ignored or slighted or dismissed by people of his ilk. It's a great credit to him.
Now, I hope we're not getting into too, inside baseball for the listeners, but Alan Brinkley, of course, his father was David Brinkley, the famous newsman. I mean, he's a very, very prominent historian. He was provost at Columbia University for a number of years. He's a professor of history there. He was a professor of history at Harvard before that. He has every establishment credential you could ask for. I just want to tell this little story that happened to me. For some reason, when I was in New York, I don't know how many years ago, I consented to be interviewed by, I don't know if it's the Columbia Political Review, some undergrad Columbia publication, and they wanted to interview me because, I'm kind of a notorious libertarian, and I got my PhD at Columbia, and they want to interview me. And I could tell right off the bat this was a person who was not exactly Thaddeus Russell. He already had labeled and pigeonholed me. It didn't matter what I said. I tried to explain that I'm not really like Bill O'Reilly. I'm not really like those people. But that's more or less how he portrayed me. And then he made it sound as if I had said that all during my Columbia career, I had been unjustly put upon by left liberals who were imposing their views on me, and I thought it was a terrible injustice. And that's not how I felt at all. I didn't feel that way working with Alan Brinkley. So I actually wrote to Brinkley to say, if you saw that article, I want you to know I didn't say anything even approaching that I always felt that you were a consummate professional. I mean, I just doggone it, you know, like what, some stinky undergrad has to go and screw up my, you know, such as it is, relationship with Alan Brinkley. So annoying. Anyway, I was glad at least to be able to tell him, I didn't say that. I'm not a little Sean Hannity. Like, you know, you didn't produce that, thank goodness. And by the way, speaking of Sean Hannity, do we tell the Sean Hannity story before you go on?
Oh, well, Sean Hannity's show called me about 20 minutes ago and asked me to be on right now. And I said, I'm sorry, I have something more important to do.
I can't get over that. What on earth did they, first of all, that's really flattering and I appreciate it. But on the other hand, I'm dying to know, what did they want you to talk about?
Oh, who knows? They just wanted, you know, 5 minutes of Sean yelling at me.
Have you ever been on before?
Yeah, I've been on a few times. He thinks I'm a leftist, sort of the traditional sort. And so he tries to pigeonhole me there. And then when I come at him from all these different angles, he gets very confused.
Yeah, well,
Start yelling.
Well, I mean, that's why he treated Ron Paul the way he did, because Ron Paul didn't fit into the two categories that you're allowed to occupy in the world. And these two categories are not nearly as far apart as Hannity thinks they are. I mean, Hillary Clinton, really? Is, you know, I mean,
right, and that's what I've tried to tell him when I've been on his shows, is that he shares a lot with progressives.
Yeah, much more than he realizes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh yeah, exactly.
All right, let's turn to your book, A Renegade History of the United States. Right off the bat, when the person opens up this book, as you're introducing it to them, you are explaining how different this is from the traditional history book you're going to pick up about the United States. The traditional book is going to be a series of U.S. presidents with the occasional sop to cultural history thrown in, maybe a little social history. But we all know that history is driven by great presidents. After all, they're looking down on us from the wall of our classrooms. That they must be the driving force in history. And you suggest that the real story has, well, let's say more texture to it.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, history was, you know, originally the great men, right? Until about the 1960s, 1970s, that's all we had in the books were the presidents and the senators and the generals and the inventors. And then that was overturned by what was called the new social history. People like the people who taught us in graduate school at Columbia, who replaced those old men in part with sort of new class of people who they pretended were representative of ordinary folks, and these tended to be labor leaders and civil rights leaders and suffragists, et cetera, often radicals as well. And that's, you know, where I started, and I was among them in that. But it seemed to me after a while of studying that those people didn't really represent ordinary people either. And that looking around the world I lived in and looking at history more deeply, you know, it became obvious to me that most people aren't Martin Luther King or Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Dwight Eisenhower. You know, they live lives that are very different than those people. And also, more importantly, they share cultural values that are often quite different and challenging to the dominant norms. So I looked very far below. I look at history from the gutter up. And I look at the people who are considered to be the scum of the earth, the lowest orders of society, people like prostitutes and drunks and criminals, gangsters, and slaves, and gays and lesbians, and I found that they simply by behaving in ways they weren't supposed to behave, they opened up many freedoms that we all now take for granted. So just by being bad, they actually created a great, great good for all of us.
I'm interested in, for example, the way you deal with the subject of the civil rights movement, because as you say just now, the traditional way of telling it would be to focus on a few leaders and then, you know, maybe some passing glance at the fact that there was a mass movement going on, but we focus on a small number of people and then we leave it there. But there's an interesting cauldron of activity that is seething beneath the surface here in your story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great untold stories, although it's now starting to be told a bit by historians, is that there was, it wasn't, you know, the traditional story of the South and segregation is this sort of top-down, one-way violence, right? This racist violence from white racists and cops and mayors and Bull Connor down on the oppressed masses. Now, that certainly was happening all the time, but what I found was, and I'm not the first historian to talk about this, but I'm the first historian to talk about it in a sustained way, I think, is that it was really a civil war and that there was quite a bit of black armed and violent resistance against racist and cop and Bull Connor's forces across the South. And that actually created the conditions that gave rise to Connor's overreaction in 1963 and other overreactions by Southern police forces during that period that created the news events, made those civil rights events into major news events and shamed the South and really led to desegregation. So that's my chapter on civil rights. I highlight that. There was a whole lot of violent resistance, sort of non-respectable resistance, that was actually opposed by the civil rights leadership that made their mission possible.
Let me switch gears completely because there are so many things I want to cover here. I want to make sure I get to them all. You have a discussion in here about changing attitudes regarding consumption. Because, of course, for a long time, the moralizers were telling people that you shouldn't consume, you shouldn't enjoy yourself. This is all immoral. You should be happy living in your hut without any labor-saving devices and so on and so forth. Now, the traditional story would be, well, we had these great people, great organizational geniuses who came up with department stores and this and that. And there's no disputing that aspect of the story, but you can open all the department stores you want to, but if people's attitudes toward consumption haven't changed, no one's going to come in.
Yeah, well, so this is a big story. I mean, this is one of the things that really moved me away from the left. I was infuriated by the constant renunciation of ordinary people's desires for things, you know. This very elitist, haughty disdain of people and their desire for material pleasures and luxuries and leisure. You found that across, I mean, certainly at Columbia where we were, but across the academic left, and I would say the left in general, you will find that it's very, very common. It's a very middle-class idea, ironically. It's a very bourgeois idea, in fact. In the 19th century, sort of rising bourgeois class began to say these things about ordinary people who went to Coney Island, who went to movies, who read dime novels, who drank whiskey at saloons. They were in the position of becoming a controlling managerial class, and so their mission was to control both the lower classes and the upper classes who indulged in these things. And so they came to embody sort of that very traditional, culturally conservative class that's defined formal American culture. And what is most ironic is that the left took up their mission. The left are the people who speak in those ways, the ways in which the middle class moralists of the 19th century spoke, that it was actually a waste of one's time or worse, degrading, to spend one's own money how they please on things like, on pleasure, on things like going to the movies, on buying clothes that were nice, that felt good, that looked good, that celebrated the self. That's how the left talks today. And they're also, it's even worse than that. The left has this theory, which has been proved by many people, including Mises, by the way, that advertisers control our minds, that we are helpless in the face of capitalists who tell us to want something and we will automatically go buy it.
Right. Now, I'm sure the capitalists wish that were the case. It would make it a lot easier to market new products. They don't even have to do any marketing research. Just come up with a good ad.
My first response to that is ask a capitalist if that's true.
Right.
I mean, they're the first people to tell you that it's the most difficult thing in the world to figure out what we are willing to spend our money on. But that's certainly true if you look at history. If you look at the history of products that have come out of the factories, right? The vast majority of them have been turned down by ordinary people. But it's even deeper than that. I mean, it's sort of this, I'm constantly sort of in a fury against the left. And that's where it really started with me. It was sort of this really nasty, elitist, and ironically very bourgeois and conservative idea that we shouldn't want things, that we should be spending our time doing other stuff, you know, which for them is, you know, we should be managing society. We should be all sort of managing our industries and our cities and our country and perhaps the world government. It's a puritanical idea as well. It's the idea that the body, the pleasures of the body, belong to the devil. They're evil. They should be shunned and renounced in favor of what is of the mind, of the spirit, of the intellect. And so it's a profoundly conservative idea that I think animates much of left-wing discourse.
Well, that's why I think a lot of these people have much more in common with a certain branch of conservatism than they realize as well, because I am in contact with a lot of conservatives who themselves, they view consumerism in, they call it consumerism, but what it really is just people trying to live a comfortable life. I mean, you consider how horrible most people's lives were throughout most of recorded history. It's unimaginable to us. Now they're trying to eke out some modicum of comfort, and they're viewed, you know, they're disparaged for this, and this is, you know, they don't understand what life is all about. And we get conservatives like Russell Kirk, whom I deeply respect on a lot for a lot of things, and he was much better on foreign policy than any other conservative I know these days. But Russell Kirk was he called the car, the automobile, a mechanical Jacobin, because it uproots you from your traditional surroundings, right? You shouldn't be able to drive around and change your identity and this and that. But likewise, I see the same kind of contempt from the left of people having their own little cars and being just selfish and consumed by their own lives. But that's how people want to live. I mean, leave people alone is my attitude. And I think that's probably the attitude of a lot of alienated leftists who don't know what happened to the left.
Absolutely. And so what you see is, you know, with the Industrial Revolution of the late 19th century, came a consumer revolution, and the ways in which people lived was radically transformed. From the early 19th century to the late 19th century, people lived completely different lives, and access to all sorts of things that they had no access to before. Now, that, for you and me and many of us, is just a cause for celebration, plain and simple. But if you look at, in my chapter on this, you know, details this, you look at this upsurge of complaint, hysteria about this. This is a terrible thing for many people. And it wasn't just people, and it mostly was not actually people we would consider to be conservatives. It was actually mostly progressive intellectuals who came up with things like budgets for working class folk that they tried to impose through state power, in fact, not always successfully, but states often sort of at least promoted these budgets they put out there that were written by progressive intellectuals about how working class people should spend their money, you know, particular dollar amount on things like going to the movies and reading books and clothes and food. But a tremendous, you know, upsurge of discourse from progressive intellectuals from about the 1880s all the way through the 1920s about how terrible it was that ordinary people were spending their money on things to make them feel better. So this is I think it's still central in left-wing discourse. I think it still animates much of what they talk about.
What I like about your telling of this is that the way this changed is that the people who were being lectured to got tired of being lectured to, and they just went ahead and made the decision to consume, to go to the stores, to buy things, to make their lives more comfortable. And you know, it's interesting. I had a historian on, well, an economist and historian several months ago named Deirdre McCloskey, and she has been interested for a long time in the question of how is it that in the Western world we saw for the first time sustained compound economic growth over a long period of time? What was it that made that possible? And the traditional textbook explanations, well, international trade or protection for private property. She says the problem with these explanations are the Ottoman Empire had them. Practically just all over the world they had those institutions, but they didn't get this explosion in growth. What was the change? And she says it was a change in the way people thought and spoke about the worthiness of merchant activity, of commerce, which had been frowned upon and looked down upon ever since ancient Greece and Rome. So again, it's a change in attitudes on the part of the general public that makes this possible.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree with her. And what I say in my chapter on this is it begins with desire. It began with desire. That we would not be living the way in which we live now, were it not for all those people in the 19th century who simply wanted more. They simply wanted more, and they demonstrated that by going out and spending their money on those things to make their own lives better, materially better, against the moral prescriptions of these progressives and others. And so there, I say, they are among our greatest heroes. They should be considered among our greatest heroes. And by the way, a lot of those heroes were young women in cities, and many of them were immigrants, in fact. Poor women really drove much of the consumer revolution of the late 19th and early 20th century. Other historians have written about this. But they were very brave in particular because women in particular were not supposed to be going out into public and spending money and sort of sexualizing themselves and wearing fancy clothes and dressing what was called above their station. But they did it anyway. They did it against all the odds and against all these moral prescriptions from these reformers. So those are the people who should be on our postage stamps.
Well, the book we're talking about is A Renegade History of the United States. I'm linking to it on the show notes page for this episode, tomwoods.com/321. Do you mind if I ask you, Thad, about the story that you've probably told more times than you care to of your experience in academia? Because I have this sense that you got screwed somehow, and I have a feeling that's how you and I, even though we've never met in person, that's how you and I got to know each other. I think it had something to do with that I was kind of an outcast, and I had also been from Columbia, and I think you may have reached out to me during some of this. Can you recall any of that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's a fairly long story, which I recounted in the Huffington Post several years ago. But
I'll link to that, too, on the page.
But I'm always happy to talk about it. I got very lucky. I got a job, a full-time job at Barnard College across the street from Columbia, which is affiliated with Columbia, right after graduate school, but not tenure track. And I had already gone through sort of a political transformation at that point. So I was definitely not anymore part of the club. But people didn't really know that because I was, you're left alone to teach in the classroom, right? People don't come and monitor what you're saying. And so I was developing these lectures, which ended up becoming A Renegade History of the United States, and giving them to these Columbia and Barnard undergraduates. And they liked it, and the classes grew tremendously and became very popular. And I was there for 5 years, and toward the end of that, a tenure track position came open at Barnard in exactly the position I was teaching. And everyone said, oh, well, you're going to get it because you're a popular teacher and kids like you. And of course, I had to give a job talk. I had to give a lecture on my work to the faculty. And so I did that, and it was actually on the Civil Rights Movement, that chapter. Ended up being that chapter. And half the faculty said it was great, and they loved it, and they thought it was a fantastic job talk. And half of them either walked out or wrote scathing emails about how I was inappropriate, had no place in the academy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so I was denied the job, and I was essentially fired. Not technically, but I was essentially fired. And I've been an adjunct ever since. And it's pretty, they've also sort of very studiously ignored my book. There's been no response to it at all, no reviews at all by academics or the left generally. And I don't know what that means exactly. I don't know if they're aware of it and are sort of doing this deliberately, or they just don't think it's worthy of them. But I've sort of, scraped together a career somewhat similar to yours, which I sort of teach part-time, and I write books and articles, and I do some public speaking. But it's pretty clear that, you're not allowed to have particular ideas, and you're certainly not allowed to take on sort of the idols of the academic left, like the civil rights leaders and labor leaders and socialists and suffragists the way I do. That really pissed off a lot of people, was my criticism of Martin Luther King for being essentially conservative, and others. So it's a really terrible culture, academia. It's a really terrible culture that is committed to, maintaining the status quo intellectually. There's no question about that. And they will do anything they can to get rid of people who challenge that. And so it's anti-intellectual, actually. I find it to be a profoundly anti-intellectual environment. It is simply the flip side of what academia was in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s when it was controlled by conservatives, right, who blacklisted communists. I feel like we are essentially being blacklisted now I think people who are libertarians or conservatives or whatever I am, or even a lot of leftists who don't toe the line, get read out of the academy. And this is a real problem, and it needs to be challenged, and I can't wait for higher education as we know it to be 6 feet under.
Yeah, of course, you're preaching to the choir here. And, your book is published by Free Press. It's not like you publish it with Joe's Underground Publishing House here. It's a major publisher. It's got endorsements that most people would kill to have. It's a serious and significant work. So the fact that they treat it that way is really all you need to know about the way these people are and how they want to hold on to their orthodoxies if it's the last thing they do.
Right. I mean, I do think its days are numbered. It's just a question of how many days those are. But, you know, I do think it will be replaced. I think technology is sort of upturning a lot of the higher education system now in all sorts of ways. And I think tenure is going to dissolve. I think sort of the broader culture is, you know, starting to question the nostrums that we were given in graduate school and undergraduate programs. But it's what needs to be said, most importantly, is that it's anti-intellectual. These people are not committed to open inquiry. They're not interested in challenging their own ideas. My ideas have changed radically over time. I mean, you know, you probably know that I was born a socialist. My parents were revolutionary socialists. I was a socialist well into my adulthood.
I didn't know that. This would have been an even more interesting show if I had. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I was basically a commie into my 30s and have changed in many ways, as you can tell. But what I now value more than anything is open inquiry. I value intellectualism. I value people who are open to new ideas. That's what I care about. Because I'm always changing my mind, and I think people should be open to that. And that's exactly what you don't find in colleges. It's exactly what you do not find in colleges, in my experience. They're very interested in the diversity of colors, races, ethnicities, gender, sexualities, as representations. They're not interested in diversity of ideas.
No, they have, exactly. They'll have this kind of outward, external form of diversity as long as all those individuals are saying exactly the same thing. What is the point of that?
Exactly, right. So I've often said, person's race may be important, but what they have to say about race is much more important. And so diversity of opinions about race and sexuality and gender, to me, I value much more than what those people are in terms of their identities, their stated identities. It's a terrible environment. I'm very interested in doing sort of basically what you're doing. I mean, it's online learning. I mean, all sorts of ways to disrupt this thing, to subvert it, and to create a new system, a new paradigm. I'm very interested in doing that. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to look like or how to do that. But I think that's what I think that people like you and I should be spending our energies on just that, on sort of replacing higher education.
Yeah, I mean I'm trying in my own small way with my different projects. I guess I'll probably put those at tomwoods.com/321 as well. To the extent that one person can, I'm trying to say to people, if you want to get another perspective on things, you're not going to find it sitting in that classroom, but you can find it from the faculty that I've assembled with my different projects and so on and so forth. I want to return, before I let you go, I want to return briefly to A Renegade History of the United States. Just to say another thing that I really like about it that impresses me is that chapter after chapter, it's true that you're saying things that the standard left liberal account tends to leave out. But on the other hand, you're saying things that a lot of undergraduates will find interesting and a lot of honest people on the left will find interesting. And then all of a sudden, you say, oh, by the way, the New Deal was like a cousin of fascism. Like, what? So, I mean, nobody is safe reading Thad Russell's book, right? No, there is no sacred cow that is not going to be attacked in this book.
That's probably true.
Well, maybe not. No, but I mean, but I thought that is so funny that he did that. You know, when you probably the path of least resistance would have been to leave that chapter out altogether, because
it
doesn't help you from the point of view of the left. But it is something that needs to be said. And I know there were some people, the handful of remaining real progressives at the time, who were uncomfortable with the direction the New Deal was going, but they were basically steamrolled.
Just the evidence is so overwhelming. the connections between European fascism and the New Deal, it's just so overwhelming, and it is so important, and it's so overlooked. I couldn't help myself. and I've had many people who thought Roosevelt was a wonderful man tell me, you know, they were amazed by it, but convinced by it. It was a very easy chapter. It was one of the easiest chapters to write because, as I said, evidence is just overwhelming. And by the way, if a handful of leftish historians have done that work, no one's really put it all together in one place John
Diggins,
John Garrity.
Oh, okay.
Did this and John Diggins. John yeah. Garrity wrote a very important article about this in AHR.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, John Diggins did as well. So, but you know, again, no one really put it all together in one place.
I mean, all you have to do is read through. I mean, what were your thoughts, by the way, when you heard that the New Republic magazine was having financial problems? Were you cheering too?
No, I said, and I said this on Twitter, I'm very sad because they proved my argument for me consistently.
That's true. Yeah.
My argument there is that, and this is my next point, is that imperialism has always been the flip side of progressivism.
Yeah, that's got to be told. Yeah, and there's that classic William Lichtenberg article on that, but there's so much more that can be written on this.
Absolutely, yeah. There's no question about it that imperialism, at least in this country, and probably in England too, comes out of progressivism. The idea that, right, it's moral imperative that we are obligated to uplift our social inferiors does not end at the ghettos, right? If we are obligated to uplift the poor in the ghettos, we should also be obligated to uplift the poor in Bangladesh and South Africa and in across the world, right? And that's exactly what progressives said in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and that's why they supported the British-American War and World War One and World War II and Korean War and the Vietnam War. I mean, that's exactly what led them into those places,
and
was the idea that, yes, we should be our brother's keepers.
You know, what's interesting, too, is that the social gospel clergy, whom you would think, you know, are following the Prince of Peace, were overwhelmingly in favor of World War I. Richard Gamble has a book called The War for Righteousness, in which he goes through very systematically and unpacks the thought of the social gospel clergy, and they are entirely for the war. And not only are they just for the war, but they are assigning traditional Christian categories to the various participants. So, of course, you know, the U.S. soldier is like another Christ, and the Germans are like the devil. I mean, it's like the neocons, except they're supposed to be on the left. But it goes to show that ultimately, if the result is war, I don't care if you're a neocon or you're on the left, you're wrong on the most important issue that really matters these days.
Well, yeah, I mean, our friend Anthony Gregory, you know, said to me once, you know, neocons are just Neanderthal progressives. They're progressives who sort of do things in not a very sophisticated way, but they have the same ideology, essentially, right? We must remake the world in our image, right? I mean, that's what drove progressives. And it wasn't just remaking the slums, it was remaking the entire world. I mean, they were universalists. This is the way not just the social gospel clergy talked about, talked about these things. It was also Woodrow Wilson, it was Teddy Roosevelt, it was Franklin Roosevelt, it was Harry S. Truman, it was John F. Kennedy. Every single one of those great progressive presidents thought in those terms. And that's what led to the creation of the American empire. In my view, that's the principal cause of it.
Is this just an idea in your head right now, or are you actually in the middle of writing this book?
I am straight in the middle of writing a book about it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I can't wait for that. That's going to be so important. And by the way, talk about a book that the left is going to ignore, right? I mean, can't acknowledge this book at all. And again, I don't mean to pile on the left, because, I mean, believe me, I spend a lot of time on this show talking about how screwy the people on the right are. But just knowing your own background, it just seems right to really let them have it here.
Yes. I mean, that's part of the book, The Left, which the left will hate very much. The other part that they will hate very much is I extend this argument about consumerism to international relations. So I tell sort of a 100-year story of American popular culture being exported abroad through markets, and how that has really caused the subversion of sort of authoritarian regimes from the Philippines in the 1900s to Nazism in the 1940s. To the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s. And today in the Middle East, you'll see that is what the imams are most concerned about, is cable news shows from America being piped through the satellite dishes on people's apartment buildings in Tehran and in Saudi Arabia, that the diffusion of American popular culture is what will bring down war on terror. And that is what has caused tremendous freedom for people across the world, despite American incursions to the military.
Well, this is going to be so important. I can't wait to read it. The book we've been talking about today, of course, is A Renegade History of the United States. Thaddeus Russell, my guest, your website is thaddeusrussell.com. I will link to that. Also, at the clearinghouse for this whole episode, tomwoods.com/321. Thanks so much for being here, Thad.
Hey, thank you.
All right, everybody. By the way, I appreciate all you who tell me you are daily listeners to the show. That really, really pleases me. And I know there are other people who say the shows accumulate so fast I can't keep up with them. Well, one way you can keep up with them if you absolutely can't listen is to get the transcripts. And I make transcripts available to all my supporting listeners who also get all kinds of neat discounts at places like the Mises Store and other places where libertarians might shop. You get the Kindle version of my new book, Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. You get little mini courses with more to come. You get signed books in the mail. You can get the courses I'm preparing for the Ron Paul curriculum. You can get subscription to libertyclassroom.com. You can get my 31-lecture course from Jeff Herberner, What's Wrong with Textbook Economics? All kinds of great stuff if you support the show. And you can do that at supportinglisteners.com. We are done with another week, everybody. Check out the show notes page, tomwoods.com/321, for everything we talked about today, and we'll see you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.